All right. Hi, everybody. This is RCFB Talk 32. My name is Bob Akhayeri, and we are loading things right now because, as always, we wish that Twitter had a green room so we could set these up, but we're just going on the fly. We're going to be joined tonight with a special guest, Chris Vanini, National College Football Reporter for The Athletic. As always, I'm joined by co-hosts JD and Sirius. And we are ready to get started. I mean, Chris, we just want to say thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Appreciate you guys reaching out. Happy to be here. Always always happy to talk college football and whatever else is on the minds of anybody.
Awesome.
I'm sure. Go ahead. I'm sure there's plenty to be talked about tonight. But first off, just off the quick look on your Twitter feed, congratulations on the new puppies in your household.
Thank you. Yeah, we typically breed one litter per year. Didn't work this year, so we ended up fostering a border collie from a local rescue that just had puppies and desperately needed a place to go. So we've done this a few times, and always something that's nice to help out some animals. If anybody ever sees any of that stuff I post about puppies and or foster dogs and has any questions about how to do it or how to get into it, would love to let you know.
So right now, because I know it was 7 puppies that just were born today, how many total dogs do you have at your house right now?
If you're counting the 7 pups, 15, if you count the 7 pups, and that doesn't count my wife, who is currently at work where she is a dog trainer with another one of our actual dogs. So we normally don't have, obviously, that many. It's just doubled in size because of this mom and her litter.
Absolutely incredible. Well, again, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. We are really excited to talk about college football with you today. I know you just recently dropped your lessons learned piece about the coaching carousel. And when it comes down to knowing which coaches are going where, whether it's head coaches, assistant coaches, G5 coaches, you name it, there are a few people who know this landscape better than you. And I would love to hear some of the lessons that you've learned from this coaching carousel and what a wild coaching carousel it was.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy to look back and think about it that, like, you know, we had USC, Oklahoma, Florida, LSU, a couple other just major jobs all open in the same cycle. Like, that is crazy. Like Oklahoma hadn't lost a coach to another college since 1947. Notre Dame hadn't lost a coach to another college since 1907. It was crazy. It basically told me that, like, no job is too good to leave anymore. You know, like anybody can go anywhere. Nobody is safe. I think we saw that in the reaction of Oklahoma fans to the news and some questioning how the program could even play in a bowl game or something like that, that this is a new feeling for a lot of people. But this is what it's a feeling for basically every other college football fan. And now everybody kind of has to think about this in every cycle. That and anybody can leave now, except for probably Nick Saban at this point. But it's wild.
I am curious. So as a guy who has covered this for a good long time, this 2021 cycle where we see all these huge changes, does this eclipse the craziness that we saw in 2017? You know, that's a season where we saw Tennessee go through about 5 different coaches and 3 athletic directors. We saw Jimbo Fisher announce he was going to Texas A&M by throwing out a Christmas tree. I mean, where does that rank in comparison?
Well, this one didn't have the juice like that. We didn't have the big scenes because it all happened so quickly. I mean, you had Lincoln Riley gone a day after he said no to LSU and lost to Oklahoma State. Brian Kelly was a few days later, and Marcus Freeman is promoted within a couple days. It was so quick because of signing day, in early signing day, and now that these changes have to happen so quickly, you don't get these drawn-out searches. There weren't as many scenes like a Christmas tree thrown out, because the idea of changing jobs after Christmas like it doesn't happen anymore. So it's a crazier cycle, but it's also a much quicker cycle. So it's a lot of stress, but it's all packed into like 2 weeks.
when it comes down to the quickness of this change, we know that, you know, head coaches, I think it was Lincoln Riley, had the Zoom call the day after the final game, had accepted and announced that he was going off to USC. But in your Lessons Learned article, you wrote really in depth what it was like for assistant coaches to have to go through that cycle. Are they seeing larger stresses now because of that timetable?
You mean assistant coaches going through more stress because these changes happen quicker?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, because for a lot of them, they still have an interim – they still have a bowl game to go to for a lot of these places. Even places that are making bowl games are firing their coaches. So they've got to deal with that while trying to figure out what their next job is. Like, that is one of the toughest spots for assistant coaches to be in, is when you're out of a job, you're a dead man walking, but you got to go there every day, talk to the kids, get them motivated for the bowl game. Meanwhile – you and your wife and your family are back home not knowing where you're going to be in a few weeks, or if you're going to be somewhere in a few weeks, and you're trying to get your own jobs, talk to other coaches. It's a really tough time. The head coaches are fine. They get the million, dollar buyouts. They get the giant contracts. They get the giant moving fees. The assistant coaches, except for the highest paid coordinators, the assistant coaches are the ones who really have to go through a lot of the stress of coaching change season. And we're not even done. Technically, there's three jobs still open. Eastern Michigan and USC have two openings. Unfortunately, some coaches have died this offseason. Very, very sad. And Ohio still hasn't filled its running backs coach. So, like, the assistant coaching carousel is actually not over.
You know, Chris, I just wanted to mention, because obviously you're very familiar with the coaching cycle. I became familiar with you with all the work you did for Coaching Search back in the day. I think that's when actually our account started following you. And I really was noticing how hard you were working. I think you were the only person working there for a good period of time, if I'm correct. But as a professional college football writer and journalist, how much did that, was that like a crash course and kind of trial by fire in terms of doing everything and having to pump out content at that level?
Yeah, that was a strange time, because like I didn't get a big job out of college. I graduated in 2011, and I was freelancing for a year, doing a bunch of different blogs, did some SB Nation stuff, did some local stuff, some Michigan State stuff. Spent a little bit of time working at a sporting goods store just to make some money. And the Coaching Search thing came around, started as a part time job, became a full time job, and that was a situation where, like, I was writing 6-7 things a day, but it had to be like stuff that other people weren't writing. Like, I wasn't just, here's an update on the Alabama quarterback situation. It was geared toward coaches. That was the audience. So it was coaching changes, and it was coaching philosophies of like why coaches do certain things. So it was watching press conferences and listening to radio interviews and talking to people about things that are unique. And so I did that for 5 years, really. And in that time, made a lot of sources in networking through coaches, because they would come to the site. I go to the coaches convention every year. So it was a different style of writing that came up. Something I always tell young writers is find a niche, find something that other people aren't doing, because it'll help you stand out that way. Like, and that's what happened. I did that for 5 years. I did it on my own for 2 years. And Stuart Mandel was a big fan of the site. So when The Athletic starts up in 2017, right when ESPN and Fox and SI and everybody laid off all their college writers, that's when The Athletic decided to start a new site. And Stuart really liked Coaching Search. And so he called me up and said, hey, I'd love for you to do what you're doing there and kind of bring it here, where we're starting a new site, and also do a lot of Group of Five general coverage, because I think that's an underserved audience. And 5 years later now, he was correct. I'm still doing a lot of that stuff, and the feedback and response from readers has been good. So it was a unique path to where I'm at. Like, I didn't work at ESPN. I didn't work at a newspaper full-time, so to speak. But it's always just finding something that not a lot of people are doing it in ways that it benefits yourself. I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was making a lot of sources. And I knew that whenever another job opportunity came, that would be valuable, and eventually it did.
Well, I agree. I mean, obviously we noticed that same period too. We were not, unfortunately, we're all, we joked that everyone on Reddit's college football site, those of us who run, we take a vow of poverty. But I mean, yeah.
Well, no, anytime a coaching search story made the Reddit page, I'd always see the numbers go up way big. So I always appreciated that whoever, any of the people who read that and put it on the site, because that always helped.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, we're always glad to help. Actually, JD, did you want to follow up with something? I couldn't.
Well, I'll let SRS go on. He just unmuted himself. SRS, go ahead first.
Yeah, Chris, just, you know, when you're talking about kind of, you know, how you developed your career, it sounds like you kind of had a little bit of an interesting chance compared to, it seems like most sports writers, you know, they come out of college, they probably start working a local beat, focusing on, you know, a really specific geographical area, but you wound up getting a chance to cover pretty much the entire country just because of the type of content that you needed to come up with. And also being able to, you're having to rely on, like you said, press conferences, videos, transcripts, things like that. Do you think that that's really helped prepare you to make that big step going to, you know, working for The Athletic in a national level? And also, you know, when we went into the whole, the COVID years, and a lot of journalists were having to switch over to Zoom, do you think that kind of helped prepare you to be able to rely on not actually being there in person in the room for those interviews, for those questions, and, you know, being able to pull your sources without actually having to physically be present?
So that second part about Zoom, everybody going to Zoom was very helpful for national writers, the ones who can't be there, because suddenly we had access to participate in press conferences that we wouldn't have otherwise. And that was weirdly fortunate for national people. For local beat people, it was terrible. I feel very bad, and I don't want to go to Zoom full time because that would obviously hurt them. But I was able to just, like I said, ask questions, jump on press conferences for coaches and people that I hadn't been able to if I wasn't in, you know, East Lansing or Tallahassee or something like that. So that was it was a weird period. But there were ways to kind of navigate it in a different way. As for helping myself get to the national spot, it did because, I had to cover national college football, so I had a better understanding of the whole landscape as opposed to if I was just covering one team all the time. I didn't. I tried to be a local beat writer. I applied to every Michigan State beat writer job that opened coming out of college. The Detroit Free Press, Detroit News, MLive, they all turned me down. So I certainly would have liked to. I just kind of lucked into coaching search at the last minute when everything else didn't pan out. But I knew it was going to be an opportunity of, hey, I'm writing about new things for a different audience and a wider audience. I'm going to get something from this. And like, I paid my own way to the coaching convention for 5 years. That was how I got to meet a lot of people. You know, the first year I go, I don't know anybody. I've got a big stack of business cards, would walk up to anybody who had a important logo on their thing and tell them who I was, tell them what the site was, and, you know, let them know what it was. By year two, year three, then everybody kind of recognized the site because the audience was coaches and coaches were following it. And so it took a couple years to build that up to now where I go, and I've got a long list of people I want to catch up with that I haven't seen in a year or two and stuff like that. So it was a lot of just doing it on my own, figuring things out kind of as it went. And fortunately, it worked out. Because after 5 years, you know, I was considering getting out because I couldn't work that grind for 24/7, no vacations, working on holidays for not a lot of money. I appreciate the money that I did get, but it wasn't something I could do long term. And then that spring, everybody remembers when everybody lays off all their college writers, and I'm like, what am I going to do? What job am I going to try to get? I got fortunate, right place, right time. The Athletic started, and Stu brought me on. So Yeah, it was a lot of certainly a bit of luck, and there's always a lot of luck involved and stuff like that.
You know, I wanted to just quickly follow up on that topic of just sort of the earlier part of the question in terms of how things change. We had a few people drop some questions onto sort of the Reddit post where we were mentioning that this was coming up. And one of the questions by, I guess, Trey Sermon Grin, you know, obviously the sport itself has changed significantly since the beginning of the pandemic. But I think he's talking about coverage. But since we are now 1.5 off seasons removed from all those cancellations, limited attendance, and daily testing, his question really is, have you noticed aspects of college football coverage that have changed permanently, or at least significantly and might seem permanent, since pre-pandemic? And I know I've heard some sport writers talk about that. I know, gosh, before the national title game, I was at a bar and Dennis Dodd was next to me, and I asked him that similar question, and he was concerned about like a lack of access because it gave everyone a little more control, and, you know, fighting sports information directors for access to people has always been an ongoing saga. But from what are your experiences, have you seen anything yourself?
Access was still a huge issue this year. I covered the Cotton Bowl here in Dallas, which typically has among the best access you can possibly have, but they end up canceling it shortly before the playoff, or shortly before the New Year's Six started, because of COVID coming back up. And so the CFP has already announced that media access will be fully back next year in the New Year's Six games, which is great. We're definitely looking forward to that. But that has definitely been a change. Honestly, for me, pandemic, not the pandemic, my job didn't change all that much. I'm at home all day anyway. I don't go to games every week. I go to some. I'll typically try to hit more local games, but like I'll travel to maybe 3-4 games in a season. I actually went to Cincinnati 3 times this year. That was my only road trip. But for the most part, I'm working at home trying to get people on the phone, and that hasn't changed really. And during COVID, when the pandemic hit and SIDs were locking everything down, you couldn't talk to anybody. That's when you kind of had to have sources already in place, coaches, staffers, athletic directors, because that, especially early on, nobody knew what was going on. And people just wanted to talk to you and be like, hey, what's going on? What are you hearing? Like, this is what I'm hearing. This is what these people are thinking. And so I ended up developing a lot more sources during that time, because that was the only way to talk to people, and people wanted to talk and figure out anything that was going on. Nobody knew. People weren't, early on, you're not leaving your house. People just wanted to talk to people. So I was able to expand, obviously, over the pandemic because of what my job was, because I didn't need to go to press conferences every week like a local beat writer. Again, the job of the national writers and beat writers is very, very different, and the beat writers have to go through so much more crap than we do. And they still do. Like I said, the access is still not fully back. Some places access was never good. I mean, talk to beat writers at Tennessee or Penn State, you'll hear horror stories of them getting just nobody week after week after week. That only got worse with the pandemic.
You mentioned that you've been up to Cincinnati 3 times recently during their playoff run. And I'm really curious, because a lot of people thought, especially when Notre Dame opened up, this might be the year that Luke Fickell was going to jump ship and leave Cincinnati. Given your knowledge of everything that's happened with the Bearcats program, with Luke Fickell and his connection to Cincinnati, what has been some of the reasons why he chose to stay during this cycle and possibly will continue to stay at Cincinnati?
Well, a big reason for it was because they still had a conference championship game to play. I mean, Marcus Freeman got the job, I'm pretty sure, before that championship game happened. Luke Fickell did not want to take attention away from what he was doing in Cincinnati. He told teams that, he told all kinds of schools that for a while, that he wasn't going to talk about the stuff until they got past the conference championship game, because the playoff was on the line, because the championship was on the line. It's the complete opposite of what happened with Brian Kelly, when they still had the possibility of making the playoff. And yet he went and took the LSU job. Luke Fickell did not want to do that. He was committed to his guys at Cincinnati. And So, you know, Notre Dame wanted to make quicker moves. It's pretty similar to what happened with Texas Tech. You know, like, they wanted Jeff Traylor, but they wanted Jeff Traylor to leave before the season was over. And he was like, I can't do that. And so, you know, that early, this is, again, where that early signing period really comes into play, where schools are trying to hire coaches as quickly as possible. And people who are happy where they are not willing to put their current team in a bad situation until they get past a certain, until they get to the end of it.
You mentioned Jeff Traylor in a very similar vein of, you know, he couldn't leave earlier in the season, but I thought it was really interesting that he got offered this huge 10-year contract. And we saw a lot of other trends go up in that way. We saw, who was it? We saw James Franklin at Penn State. We saw Mel Tucker at Michigan State. It kind of seems like at least 10 years is that new guarantee from schools. Is it because these other schools are demanding more opportunity, like Jeff Traylor having opportunities with places like TCU and Texas Tech, or Mel Tucker being shopped around, James Franklin famously always being shopped around to a place like USC, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, it's kind of what I said at the beginning, which was no job is too good to leave. So now schools really want to lock in their coaches where they can. Not only did Jeff Traylor sign a 10-year deal at UTSA, but that's he's got a huge buyout on there, like a buyout at a Group of Five level that, like, we've never seen before. So he's going to be there for a few years still. It's the kind of buyout that, outside of maybe Texas, that not a lot of schools can really jump on to pay. Similar to Penn State a bit as well. Mel Tucker's buyout at Michigan State didn't change. It's the same as it was before. So he technically could leave next year for the same thing if he wanted to. But what the deal is $95 million guaranteed, so he doesn't have to leave. He's going to get paid either way. He's probably not going to leave for another college job now. He may leave for an NFL job if he wants to go up there. But, you know, the James Franklin one was surprising, because I just felt like nobody wanted that. I don't think James Franklin or Penn State want to be together for 10 years. and yet they are. And so, shoot, good for him, I guess. Too bad for the beat writers that have to cover him and the lack of good player access that they get. And, you know, I was talking, you know, I included it in the story, but I was, like, talking to an agent about it, and it was like, this agent was telling me, nobody would give James Franklin a 10-year deal. Like, you're Penn State. Like, you can get another good coach. Why are you committing so much to him coming off of two letdown seasons? But nobody wants to go through a coaching search anymore. If you have a coach who's halfway decent, you know, athletic directors are scared to lose him now.
You had also briefly mentioned the NFL, and in your lessons learned piece, you made the really astute note that, you know, we saw Matt Rhule go to the NFL, but we really haven't seen a whole lot of other coaches make the jump like we had maybe 20 years ago. Is there a specific reason why we haven't seen necessarily as much NFL interest? I know that we had, like, Jim Harbaugh looking at the Minnesota Vikings at one moment, but is there a reason that NFL leverage maybe isn't as much of a thing anymore, or is it a thing?
Well, part of it is I don't think the NFL is as interested. Matt Rhule being on the hot seat, Urban Meyer's career being a mess. The track record of college coaches moving up is pretty terrible outside of Pete Carroll, and I guess Cliff Kingsbury's done a solid job. That's about it. The NFL is not looking to get any kind of college coach out there anymore. The Kingsbury one was weird. I mean, the dude had just been fired. Texas Tech. He gets an NFL job. Still one of the weirdest things I've ever seen.
Yeah, they poached him from USC's coordinator position, which he had for, like, a hot minute.
that was weird. But, like, I made the same point last year, and it was last season when you started to see a lot of anonymous coach quotes about how frustrated they are by things and how they want to go to the NFL more. They're thinking about the NFL. And 2 years in a row, none of it. You know, there were those weird reports last year that Dan Mullen was looking to go to the NFL. But, you know, Ryan Day still at Ohio State. Pat Fitzgerald still at Northwestern. Matt Campbell's still at Iowa State. A lot of these coaches people think are possible for the NFL. It's just it's not happening right now. And I think it's a lot of coaches just generally complaining about things they have to do, which is, you know, admittedly a lot more than what it used to be, but they're also paid a gazillion dollars to deal with it. So, you know, coaches, everybody likes to complain sometimes, but this idea that coaches are just run into the NFL, even if they want to, the NFL is not necessarily calling. It's got to be a two-way street here. Jim Harbaugh wanted to go to the NFL. The Vikings said no thanks. Nobody else wanted him. Like, it is what it is at this point.
So one of the questions that we also had asked, and that I think is foremost on a lot of minds of folks who follow G5 football, and obviously it's in your wheelhouse, what do you think is going to happen to Conference USA? Will it endure? And if so, this is the question that TSU Player 74 asked. If so, who would get the next invite? And if Conference USA, therefore, does not survive, where would all these teams go? And as a side note, I think the first time I ever met you in person was at that kind of back-to-back Big 12 media day, Conference USA media day. I think, remember, right. They were like in the same complex when they were both at the Star.
Yeah,
it was kind of a neat arrangement they had there, but I'll set that aside. Who cares about that right now? But I think really a lot of people, that's the number one question with G5 football, is can Conference USA make it?
I think it will. It's not going to lose anybody anymore. It has added schools. I think they're, you know, once everything shakes out, I think they're currently going to be at 9. I would imagine they're going to look to add some more, but everybody's waiting for the transformation committee first, because part of that process could be, what does it take to be Division I? What thresholds do you have to hit to be Division I or to be FBS, something like that? And I think they're waiting for that to settle before they figure out exactly who could be in the mix. And as for the potentials that are in the mix, Eastern Kentucky nearly got into the Sun Belt a number of years ago. Instead, the Sun Belt went with Coastal Carolina. Now, would Western Kentucky be okay with Eastern Kentucky in there? I've heard mixed things about that. Western Kentucky was obviously more than willing to jump to the MAC, but Middle Tennessee didn't want to do it. Other possibilities you've heard are Tarleton State, which is actually still in the process of moving up from D2 to D1, but they've got a lot of money behind them. Stephen F. Austin. Here's some McNeese State, but a lot of people have questions about kind of the budget size there. No, nobody really fully stands out yet. And I think it's going to kind of take, it's going to, you know, they would love UConn football. You know, they had talks with UConn. UConn didn't really want to do it. UMass would love to come, but it doesn't appear to be much interest from Conference USA. So there are options. But I think it's still kind of in a waiting period right now.
You know, you're more knowledgeable about this, and I'd love to just ask, where do you think a team like, do you think Florida A&M would ever try another go at trying to move up?
Well, I'm not as well-versed with FCS, but they're currently moving conferences. Is that right? Aren't they moving within? I know there's a lot of movement within the HBCUs. I don't exactly know where they're at, but I think it's possible. I'm not knowledgeable enough to really say, though.
No, no worries. They're kind of a mystery out there.
Yeah.
You had
I don't remember if they're moving from the SWAC or something like that, because I know there's been some movement there. I don't remember.
Yeah, there's been a lot of shifting in that neighborhood between the SWAC and the MEAC, and people just straight up leaving and going to obviously Big South and Colonial Athletic. It's been a shakeup in all of that. You know, you had an opportunity to talk to Joe Moglia, who is one of the most interesting people I've ever talked to, college football or outside of college football, and obviously with his background in finance and running one of the larger financial companies in the United States, he brings a lot to the table. You know, you talked to him about sort of fixing college sports. What was your takeaway from that?
The biggest thing from him is he is just like appalled at the lack of leadership and the lack of decisiveness. So there was a conference here in Dallas a few weeks ago, part of the Lead One Association, which is like kind of like an athletic directors group. They were here in Dallas for a couple of days to just kind of talk about things and meet some companies and whatnot. But the last day, Joe Moglia was invited to give a speech, and they let me sit in on it but I couldn't report on it. And he just said some really interesting things and was pretty blunt about what he thought about the state of college football. And I've talked to Joe before. I did a story when he left, or when he stepped down at Coastal to let Jamie Chadwell take over. And I was like, all right, I'll circle back with Joe and kind of pick his brain a bit more on this stuff. So we talked two weeks ago or so, and he basically gave me the whole speech again. So that was nice. And he just laid out the things that he's frustrated with. And he's like, if this was a business, the entire board would be fired. The entire executive team would be fired for just letting things happen with having no control, not having a hand in any of the stuff that's going on. And, you know, he thinks there should be an executive committee that has essentially autonomous power, that they get to make all the decisions, like the board of a company or something like that. Those people can be voted in, voted out, whatever, but they got to have the power and they make the calls, as opposed to going through a million different committees with people ranging through all different divisions and that long bureaucratic process. He said, you need to make radical changes, and you need to make them now. Otherwise these changes are going to be forced on you, which is what we've been seeing with all the lawsuits. So that was the biggest thing. And there were other small parts. Like, he thinks you should get rid of signing day, that kids should be able to sign whenever. But if you offer a kid, you've got 48 hours to make a decision. You know, that'll make everybody more upfront with each other. He hates the buyouts in coaches' contracts, coaches that leave for jobs, you know, after a couple of years without a problem. And now with the portal, they can take players with them, as we've seen at a lot of schools. He doesn't like the one-time transfer rule. He thinks that should be repealed. It's not going to, but he doesn't like that. And then kind of a bigger thing, like, you know, the reorganization of FBS. Should there be a Super League? Should there be a Power 5 breakaway? He's like, I'm not sure, you know, if I even like it, a lot of these ideas, but college football is a business now, and these people have to treat it like a business. That was kind of the biggest thing. You know, he's the former CEO of TD Ameritrade. You know, the company grew dramatically under his watch. He spent more than 20 years in finance, so he's kind of got a good grasp of this stuff. And he's always kind of brought a fresh and interesting perspective to the issues of college sports.
So I just wanted to take a quick second to station ID everyone. You're listening to RCB Talk 32 with special guest Chris Vanini from The Athletic. You know, Chris, we also want to respect your time. Do you still want to stay on and talk, or do you need to wrap up?
Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm just sitting here by myself. I'm all good. Just watching some
awesome
basketball.
No, we're enjoying it, and I know our guests our audiences too. JD.
Yeah. So, Chris, you brought up some of that conversation about the Super League and things breaking off between FBS and a potential power, especially when you consider some of the things with the SEC money, the Big Ten deal that's coming up. We see Cincinnati, UCF, these other perennial G5 powers moving up into Power 5 over the next couple of years here. What does the future of the G5 look like with this type of new landscape?
So I should have mentioned this at the end, but of the Mowgli answer, but I didn't want to go long. But the idea of a breakaway, the idea of splitting up, it's a lot easier to say than it is to do. And you're getting more people saying it. You're getting commissioners and ADs saying it. But I don't know if anybody really has the full grasp of how to do it, because that would involve conferences working together. And recent history has shown that they're not very good at that. 2020, they can't even agree whether or not to play football. 2021, they can't agree on whether or not to expand the playoff. How are they going to create their own organization with their own rules, and they're going to agree on all this kind of stuff? The Big Ten and the SEC, they may be the power two in terms of money. They are very, very different in terms of what they want college sports to be and how they want it to run. So, like, it's easy to just like say it should be this, but it's going to be really, really hard to do it. That's why something like Gene Smith's idea of the college football playoff essentially running football is a more interesting concept. And the idea that, you know, maybe the NCAA still controls some certain things like eligibility and enforcement and some of this other stuff, but the rules of football, the limits on things, maybe we let football do that on its own. And again, we're going to have to wait to see what the transformation committee comes up with. There's already stuff that could happen, such as unlimited coaches, such as potentially unlimited scholarships that may come to football potentially. It's still up in the air, hasn't been decided. But we could be having these major changes pretty soon anyway within the current setup. And something John Infante mentioned on Twitter the other day, which I've been hearing and saying for a while, is that the Power Five already have autonomy. They can make a lot of rules by themselves. They haven't done that. So this idea that they're just going to decide to make their own organization or something like that, I'm just a lot more skeptical of it. ADs and commissioners, they can say, you know, big things, talk about big ideas, and it'll get headlines and stuff like that. I'm just very skeptical of the ability to get any of it done.
Do we see that type of dysfunction down at the G5 level? Do we see conferences a little bit more willing to work together? I think, kind of back to the Super League that wasn't between, I believe it was CUSA and Mountain West, where they were going to have the champions play against each other. Do we see more collaboration at the G5 level than we do the Power 5 level?
Some of them are trying. I mean, I remember last year, Conference USA wanted to set up some sort of scheduling agreement with the American. The American just brush it aside, didn't take it seriously. I think there's a lot more interest in collaboration between the four Group of Five leagues that are not the American. You know, the American is still very much pushing its Power Six thing. Mike Oresco still loves to say Group of Four from time to time. He does not want to be associated with the other Group of Five leagues. And so that is, I wouldn't call it dysfunction or anything. It's just, it's been that way for a while. But there could be other situations like scheduling agreements of some kind. It's tough for football because you can't do it like you can for basketball. We can come up with new ideas every year. But I think like a league like the Mountain West, it knows what it is. The Sun Belt, you know, with its new direction, it knows what it is. And I think you're seeing more of that moving forward.
So we have a couple of our usual guests to sort of listeners who join us up here a lot who wanted, I think, participate. Juwan. Juwan, did you have something you wanted to ask Chris? I think we got him by surprise there. We'll take a second.
All right, here we go.
Oh, no, Juwan, there you are. Hey, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to know, in his opinion, is NIL affecting the game of football as much as everyone thinks it is?
No, it's not.
Thank you.
Who's getting the most players? Who's getting the best players? It's Alabama. It's Ohio State. It's Georgia. It's the same teams that always have. It's
the same teams that it always was. Do you think they're using that as a scapegoat now? As far as them as a scapegoat, I mean, as far as getting out recruited, they're using NIL as a scapegoat, saying, "How can we compete with them? We don't have enough money." That's what I think NILs became.
I think there are some of those top schools that maybe don't have the same level of booster funding that see what Miami is suddenly doing, and they get a little frustrated by that. But there's not a lot of Miami situations out there. It's more like the Texas situation or Oklahoma, which is going to apparently pay everybody who's on the team. I think there is some concern from schools that money is now going elsewhere instead of to the schools, and yet they're still going to have to compete at that level. I think most people are okay with kids getting money. They just want order to it. And I think the transfer part of it has played a huge role in this. The one-time transfer rule on top of NIL has been a big thing. The idea of tampering, the idea of reaching out to see if players want to transfer, that's always been around. That was around before the portal existed, before NIL existed. It is happening more so. You know, hey, come to our school, we can get you an NIL deal and stuff like that. But overall, I think it's just a lot more work, but I don't think it's changing the results of kind of how college football works.
Adam, I know you also wanted to ask a question this evening.
Yes. Chris, appreciate it. Wanted to ask, so I'm a football coach, and there's a little website called Football Scoop, and they had a nice little article about the state bill in California. And my question is, do you think, and this goes back to kind of NIL, but also conference stuff, Do you think how states start to treat NIL deals or basically for the gist of the article, it is California has a bill that is getting worked through that if a school makes more than what it would cost for the full grant aid and everything that they already give, you know, they give like a percentage of that money goes back to the football players, and specifically basketball players is what the article talked about. But how much do you think like state laws are going to start changing with respect to NIL and, you know, other things that could cause problems for schools across the country?
That's changing a lot. I mean, obviously that's what started this whole thing, but something you've seen from a number of states recently is pulling back on their laws, where they're saying, like the state of Missouri and Illinois might be doing this, where the school can facilitate the NIL deal, which is explicitly against the NCAA rules. But the states want to give their schools the advantage, and so they want to do this. And I think you're going to see more states doing it, and it just eventually is going to come down to, is the NCAA going to – they can't actually do anything. State laws are laws. Are they going to penalize a school for following a state law, even if it's not an NCAA, even if it's against an NCAA bylaw? That's what we're going to have to wait and see. That's what we don't know. We got a lot of schools that are willing to call the NCAA's bluff, and we'll have to see. And if it happens and we get a lawsuit, that'll take years to resolve. So we're not going to get any resolution on any of this NIL stuff anytime soon. The California bill is a little bit different. And obviously, I don't know the details of the whole thing. I've read a little bit on it. I haven't seen the whole thing yet. The bill has been changing through this process, and it could change again by, I think it's Thursday, when the committee looks at it. But that's a situation I don't think schools are going to want to do, because they are going to be forced to give a lot of their own money to the players. That's different than letting a third party give all the money they want to players. And given the sway we've seen from a lot of programs have in their state governments, I mean, Georgia changed its FOIA laws for Kirby Smart. I don't think you're probably going to see something like that continue, because I don't know how much of a recruiting advantage necessarily that's going to be, especially if you're at a school that has boosters already offering a ton of money anyway. So I'm a bit skeptical of exactly what kind of change the California bill will have as it relates to recruiting. Because I think a number of schools actually don't want that.
Well, and to kind of, I guess, bring up another question then, what do you, you know, we were talking about the expansion of, you know, what conferences or what sports basically can control what they want to do as a institutional basis down to a conference level. Do you think that'll be the biggest difference between what we see if teams do go kind of to, hey, we're making our own rules? Do you think that'll be the biggest deal? Because, you know, obviously Pac-12 schools have a little bit different rules than SEC and Sun Belt, and obviously just the locations that the states, you know, that the schools reside in matter.
So, what exactly is the question? Sorry.
So, like the Pac-12, and specifically in California, you know, you have so many Pac-12 schools, and for football purposes, you know, what kind of differences that would make in the expansion of like a you know, SEC schools? Like, I think that's pretty primarily what you're talking about, expanding and kind of creating their own laws, bylaws, how they play it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Sorry.
Make it clear. So it kind of comes back to the transformation committee and what they want to do. You know, if they go unlimited coaches, or at least say conferences, you can kind of do whatever you want with that stuff. You can be sure the SEC is going to say, all right, we're going to hire as many coaches as we want. We're going to hand out scholarships to as many baseball players as we want. You know, that idea of no limit on the headcount for scholarship players, it's really going to probably impact non-revenue sports a lot more. If a school wants to put all its money into lacrosse, it can. If it wants to put it into baseball, it can. but schools in the SEC are typically averaging about 17, 18 sports at a school. The Big Ten and the Pac-12, that's like 25, 26. They're spending a lot more money on things that are not football. And so, you know, if the SEC is going to get so much more money and there's no limit on what they can do and they start putting together these massive coaching staffs and these massive rosters with 100 scholarship players or something like that, if that gets allowed, that is going to create a lot of change across the landscape of college football because there's just a different value of football in different places of the country. It's just it's always been that way. And so that also goes back to what I said, where the conferences don't agree on a lot of things, and they're going to be trying to one-up each other in different ways if they have the freedom to do that.
By the way, that was a great point. I always forget how some of these Pac-12 schools, you know, support so many different sports beyond the others, and to some extent helps pad their national championship counts in versus some of the other schools. You know,
well, like the SEC doesn't have men's soccer. Like they don't have men's soccer. There's a lot of sports that they just don't sponsor that you wouldn't even think about, and as a result, they end up getting to spend more money on football.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It makes total sense. Hey, Coach White, I know you wanted to ask a question.
Yeah, everybody there?
Sure are.
Yep.
Yeah, I got a question. At what point does the all this money that the kids potentially can make, at what point does that, you know, scholarships become income, and at what point does the IRS start stepping in on these kids?
Well, with the NIL stuff, I mean, they're stepping in now. I mean, I think it was Texas A&M. I don't know, it was A&M or Florida. Andy Staples wrote two really good stories on them. But one of them was holding a lot of the money that they were going to give kids until right before tax day. So just in case they got hit with a tax bill and they didn't realize it, they would have some money to pay that. That's a big part of this that, you know, schools or collectives or people need to be paying attention to these kinds of things.
I guess my concern is nobody's talking about that. Now the scholarship becomes also income. It becomes a perk of your work, which is what this is becoming. And nobody, I don't know, are they lining these kids up with accountants and all this preparation? Because nobody's talking about this, and it's a big problem.
Right. Some of the collectives are, again, I think Andy's story mentions stuff like that, but certainly some of them are not. There are definitely places that are not handling things well, and that's these things are just going to, like, settle with time. The market's going to figure itself out, realize if it's a good investment in players or not. You're going to see some collectives probably go under because it's not working out. You've got a number that are registering as charities, which I think is quite skeptical, and I'm curious if the government will take a look at that at some point. As in, if you're getting all this money and you're just giving it directly to players, at what point is that just tax evasion? You know, like that's something that I think is going to need to be looked at as well. I know that the phrase Wild West is way, way overblown when it comes to this stuff, but it's on that kind of issue that people don't talk about as much, that players probably don't think about as much, that I think there's not a lot of direction. And I think a lot of people could end up getting hurt because of that.
Yeah, and I think the scary thing for me is, like, what happens when they start issuing these kids, like, a 1099 and they have to pay a 40% tax rate? Like, they don't know they're 18 years old. I mean.
Right. And, you know, even back when they gave out the cost of attendance, I think it was Mississippi State said that they were going to, like, require their players to go through a financial aid course or financial course to in order to get that. Schools are trying. I can't speak with great detail on how different places are handling it, but it's definitely something that people need to make sure they're explaining to kids.
Maybe they're the next version of NFTs to help cleanse laundering money or things. Who knows? But, you know, serious, I know you wanted to add something here.
Yeah, you know, just some of the comments that we've heard from people that are kind of poo-pooing the idea of NIL, not saying that's what you were doing, Coach White, but it made me think of it, is, you know, we do hear that argument of, these kids, you know, 18-year-olds, they don't need to be getting all this money. It's too much money for someone that young. And obviously there are industries where 18, 19-year-olds or younger are making, in some cases, millions or tens of millions. You know, we see baseball players that go straight out of high school and they're getting a, you know, maybe a $9 or $10 million signing bonus. But in that sense, it kind of makes me think of what we've heard with similar arguments with basketball, with players that were one and dones. And you could very, very obviously tell the difference between the typical blue bloods who were in it for the long haul and needed the one and dones to keep their programs competitive, but also had to stay, you know, keep up their APRs and things like that, where, you know, you still have to go to class. We're going to make you take some personal finance courses, some financial management courses, so that you know what to expect when you get out of here after one, maybe two semesters. The plan for if you want to come back to get a degree, you know, what that pathway looks like versus the teams that were in it and, you know, hey, if they could land a five-star, they're going to, you know, ride that to as much success they could as they could in 1 year. And if it all blew up after that, then whatever, you know, take what you can get kind of approach. And that's kind of what it makes me think of is, you know, it seems like as this progresses, it's not just going to be about who has access to the best collectives or the most money offers, but also you feel like probably players are going to talk and the ones who are offering the resources to make the most of those deals, even if they're not directly involved, that's kind of going to be a little bit of a side benefit for recruiting maybe.
Yeah, and just to be clear, sorry, I didn't mean to cut anybody off. Just ahead. To be clear, I was not advocating for or against like student athletes receiving money. My point is simply this, like from a legality standpoint, if you provide a service or you receive income, you have to report it to the government and you will be taxed for it. If you do not pay those taxes, they threaten you with jail time. And therefore, they are not doing that, which regardless of how they set it up, that's just the law. It doesn't matter if it's sports or you know, you're selling cars or whatever it is, like that is the law. Like that has been established over hundreds of years. There's no way around that. And that's what concerns me is no one's talking about that. Like it's not a sports issue. You are receiving income and you are not reporting it. That's the scary part. So let's just be clear about that. It has nothing to do with me advocating for or against student athletes getting paid. I think they should. But again, they are receiving income and they are not paying taxes on it potentially, which is a huge legal problem.
Well, I think, I mean, we don't know that they're not yet because, I mean, this is still just started. And like I said, there have been collectives and schools that have said that they have these things set up to make sure that they're doing it. It's something that us in the media don't pay much attention to or write about. So people just don't know as much. And we probably should do a much better job of making paying attention and stuff. It's also a little bit different than, you know, like a one and done NBA player where they're on a pro team. So they've probably got somebody involved to help them out. Like they've got it's a group of professionals on a major organization as opposed to a bunch of different colleges that have all kinds of people running around doing different things. So, yeah, it's definitely something that needs to be paid attention to. And I'm sure at some point we'll find out about something. I'm sure something will land at some point where something didn't go right or players didn't pay something or what have you. I think we just kind of don't know yet because we literally just passed tax day since the first time this started. And we kind of got to wait and see what happens.
You know, someone just texted me a question. Someone who knows my personal number and is listening, which I think is hilarious. I don't think I've ever had that happen before. But my question for Chris would be, how long will it take until schools can essentially will realize they could have unlimited scholarships versus via NIL? And I guess they make a reference to possibly BYU.
Right. I think BYU has actually mentioned that. Satake said in an
exactly
interview that
what it says. It says parentheses like BYU.
Yeah, I think he actually said that was one of the first things they did was they tried to get funding lined up for their players. Maybe they didn't do it, but, you know, hint, hint, right, for all their walk-ons.
Yeah, well, that's technically not allowed. And that's something the NCAA reemphasized. Well, not allowed in NCAA world, not the real world. That was something that the NCAA reemphasized in their guidelines was that you can't pay players for just being on the roster. That's pay for play. And so you can't do that. So BYU, them giving all that money just to the walk-ons is kind of that. The Barry Switzer Oklahoma thing where they're going to give everybody on the roster X amount of dollars. That's pay for play. Now, whether or not you think it's right, wrong, whatever, technically that is straight up against the NCAA rules. And so we got to wait and see if the NCAA does anything like that or not. When the BYU thing happened, that's what a lot of people wondered was, hey, unlimited, hey, unlimited scholarships, are you going to go there? Well, are you going to want to go there and be the 95th or 100th player on the BYU roster? Or are you going to want to go somewhere where you can play? Because you're still recruiting kids anyway. And that's where it kind of comes down to, at some point there's diminishing returns and you can only have so many people before somebody wants to go actually play.
You know, one, another question that we've been curious about is, who do you think among the G5 conferences seems to have won this latest round of realignment?
You say G5 leagues or teams? Sorry.
I say conferences.
I'm sorry, you cut out real quick again there. Oh, yeah, sorry, what was that?
Conferences. Yeah, sorry
about conferences. That. I think the Sun Belt, for sure. I think the Sun Belt is really positioned to be a strong conference moving forward and one with an identity. By adding Marshall, Southern Miss, Old Dominion, James Madison, you've really got a group there, especially in like that East Division. You've got a lot of schools that are really close to each other. Some of them have previously been rivals before, and I think there's a lot of excitement about that. There's a lot of bus trips you can take, something like that. And I think people in the league are really excited about that. The Mountain West is a winner just for not losing anybody and kind of reasserting its strength and potentially being the number one Group of Five league coming out of this by nature of not losing its top teams like the American did. Because there's like a formula, there's like a computer formula that ranks each Group of Five conference at the end of the year 1-5, and you get more of a playoff share as a result of that. The Mountain West does very, very well in that and believes moving forward it is positioned to be at that number one spot. The American, a lot of people skeptical of that move, adding six Conference USA teams, going for the big markets, adding a school like Rice in some places that don't have a lot of football attendance. There's a lot of skepticism and people mentioning how that's going to hurt them in that formula, that playoff formula in terms of who gets the payout. So, you know, Mike Oresko is really confident in what they're doing. You know, he every time I see him, he's like, this is going to work. We're going to surprise people. And look, he's proven people wrong before. So we'll wait and see. But I think the Mountain West and the Sun Belt moving forward are really in a good position.
Well, Chris, there's one question I did want to probably wrap up with because we want to respect your time, but it blends into your other interests and my own, gosh, younger interest when I used to go watch pro wrestling in beautiful Bakersfield, California, the armpit of the state. Got to see Andre the Giant, you know. Oh, gosh. High Five, you know, guys like Coco Beware and the Bushwhackers, all those folks. But anyway, which college football players do you think have made the best pro wrestlers in history?
Well, I mean, we know The Rock played defensive lineman at Miami, and I don't know if anybody here has watched that TV show Young Rock, but it's actually a pretty solid show. In the first season, Mario Cristobal delivers a season-ending injury to The Rock, and I don't know if that's true. I'm pretty sure it's not. I mean, he got hurt, but I don't think it was Mario Cristobal who did that, and my former colleague at The Athletic, Tyson Alger, who covered Oregon for us, kind of asked Mario Cristobal about that one time, and Cristobal said he hadn't seen the show, so I'm not so sure if that was how that played out. But I also did a story actually a couple weeks ago on Ron Simmons, and I think he's a player who is kind of forgotten in Florida State lore, unless you're a Florida State fan. But like, he was the first like big player that Bobby Bowden signed. He was top recruit, everybody thought he was going to go to Georgia, all these things. He goes to Florida State because he loves Bobby Bowden, and they end up playing in a couple of Orange Bowls as he goes on. He ends up becoming a College Football Hall of Famer. This dude played nose tackle. Let me see if I can find the stats. His stats as a freshman, as a sophomore, searches him. Ron Simmons had, as a nose guard, as a freshman, 128 tackles, 12 sacks, 13 forced fumbles. As a nose tackle, dude was insane. He goes on to, you know, be a College Football Hall of Famer, WWE Hall of Famer. He might be the one of the best college football to pro wrestling guys of all time. And then Roman Reigns, current champion, he's great. He was all ACC lineman at Georgia Tech. You've got Stone Cold Steve Austin played at North Texas. John Cena played for like some D3 school or something like that.
I think Ric Flair played as at least was wrestling. Briefly on the Gophers. Like I believe,
he got recruited to go play there. I don't think he stayed there very long, but I'm pretty sure he went there. Which also means that when he teamed up with Jim Harbaugh to do that Michigan signing day, that was really kind of turning on his Gophers there. But I guess Ric Flair is kind of a fan of every sports team these days. He's kind of the new Kenny Chesney, if you think about it.
Yeah, and you know, I could nerd out on this really hard, but West Texas, I think, may lead in terms of the most unlikely schools to have just turned out an enormous number of wrestlers. Most of them from eras probably long ago for most people, but I mean, you know, the Funks, Blanchard, a lot of those.
Yeah, Tully Blanchard, Bruiser Brody, Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, Stan Hansen, the Funks, Dusty Rhodes. Yeah, they've got a West Texas A&M. Actually, a couple years ago, it was just nearby there on the west side of the state. Oddly, probably the best college football to pro wrestling place there is.
The Unknown Pipelines. Well, you know, Chris, we really appreciate you joining us. I mean, this was wonderful. We try to keep it within an hour, just to respect everyone's time. But thank you so much. I'm sure the audience got as much out of that as we did. And on behalf of JD and Sirius and all of us, we hope all of you have a great week. And we will be here again next Tuesday night. So thanks again, Chris, and everyone have a great night.